Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, August 14th, day number 216 of 2014. Today we're going to be chatting with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to be doing the second segment of looking back at World War I. As you may remember from our previous show, it was 100 years ago this month that the First World War began. We talked last week about some of the things that were going on in Europe that led so many countries to go into war. Tonight we're going to start looking at the war itself. And Barry has a few battles that he's going to share with us and just sort of take us through that time period of 1914 to 1916 or so. We're going to be looking at that period tonight, maybe not quite that long, but definitely we'll be looking at the early stages of World War I. Just a quick heads up, you know, audible.com, your source for audiobooks. We have a link to audible.com and the show information. If you're looking for an audio book, and many people like to, you know, listen to the books as they're driving or whatever, just go to the show information, and you'll see a link to audible.com. Check it out. Go there and see if there's a book that you want to get. And if you find one, hey, we'll be very happy to hear that you ordered a book from audible.com. They have a great selection, by the way. That much I can tell you. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Barry right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let me say hello to Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well this evening. Thank you for asking.
All right. How is everything out there in the West Coast?
You know, the weather out here is just so miserable. It's sunny all the time. A little bit hot because it's summertime, but the humidity is so low that, you know, what we consider hot, you guys would probably consider to be very pleasant, you know, in Texas.
We probably wear a coat when it gets like it gets in your part of the country, but it's great to have.
Well, you know, there's so little humidity that even when it gets up to about 95, it's not bad. It has to get into the hundreds before we, you know, really get sweltering out here.
Yeah. Well, Barry, before we get started with our topics tonight, we're going to look at a couple of current events, but I wanted to begin. I have a blog post tomorrow at the American Thinker regarding this situation in Missouri, and I'm basically making the point that I think it's better for our elected officials, including President Obama, to stay silent at a time like this. Obviously, everybody regrets the loss of this young man, and I don't know what happened. Nobody really knows. Eventually, this will go into a legal proceeding where we will find out, just as we did with Zimmerman a couple of years ago and the young man who was killed down in Florida. But I think for the time being, Barry, the best thing the politicians can do is to say nothing. Because when many politicians say something, they're just putting gasoline in the fire. And certainly in the case of President Obama, he wasn't irresponsible in what he said today. I mean, it wasn't that he said something really, really bad. He did say it was a time for healing. But I wish he hadn't said anything, Barry. That's the point that I'll be making tomorrow in my little American Thinker post. What are your thoughts about what's happening in Missouri?
Well, first, there always seems to be certain elements that whenever there's a shooting like this or an incident like this, of police killing a young black man, There are certain elements that always seem to immediately blame the police and accuse them of brutality before the facts are really known. And it doesn't have to necessarily be the police, because you remember the Zimmerman case was the same sort of thing. And once the facts become known, often the hysteria that followed the shooting proves to be misfounded. So I'm withholding judgment. I think the president would be wise to do the same thing. He made a comment today that bothered me, in that it seems to imply that the police are already misconducting themselves. When he says the police shouldn't do A, B, and Z, it assumes the police are doing those things. Right. We don't know the police are being particularly brutal. I haven't heard of any police shootings except one since the incident began, or since the incident occurred. What we do know is there's been a lot of lawless conduct by elements in that community and from outside that community coming in to take part, which also seems to happen a lot. Whenever there's, think of the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. As soon as there's any excuse to take to the streets, some people will. And it's always astonished me how they tend to burn down their own neighborhoods.
That's right.
You know, what good does that do?
Well, it doesn't do anything good. On the contrary, that just makes things a lot worse. And I was watching a lady this evening who is from that part of Ferguson, I guess it's the name of the town, and she was saying that, you know, that many of the people who were looting and creating all these problems were not even from the town. They were basically people from the outside who were coming in to take advantage of the situation. I think my point about all of this is that we have I have three sons, so obviously I can sympathize with the parents of this young man. I mean, it's a terrible thing to lose your son, obviously. But I'm not going to jump to any conclusions. I'm going to wait until this goes into a courtroom, and let's see what happens when a jury looks at the facts. And it was the case with Zimmerman. I mean, they had Zimmerman convicted, and then, look what the jury decided, that he didn't do anything. I think with this police officer, they're going to have to prove that he killed this young man because the young man's skin color. And that's a very difficult thing to prove in the heat of the action, Barry.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to say that police are always right by any means, and that there's never cases of police misconduct. But we shouldn't spring to defend the victim in every case before we know the facts. It's tragic when anyone loses their life in this, that young and under these circumstances. But we don't know yet what the facts are. And this young man, like Trayvon Martin, may have done certain things that were just stupid and certainly unwise, that got him put him in a set of circumstances that led to his death. So, I'm not going to blame the police for doing anything wrong until I know they've done something wrong.
That's it. That's it. And I think that, look, the police is out there. When we're sleeping, the police is out there at tough times of the day in rough neighborhoods. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt most of the time. Now, if a police misbehaves or does something that he shouldn't do, yes, of course, you throw the book at him. But, let's hear both sides. And that's the whole point of my article, is that I think the political leaders should not be passing judgment one way or the other in this. Just be silent and simply say, let the process work and take it from there. Barry, that's what I think should be doing. We need silence right now. We don't need, we certainly don't need Reverend Sharpton coming into town. I mean, that right there is a problem.
Well, that's always a problem. Anytime Sharpton opens his mouth, it's a problem. I think the man's a national embarrassment. But that aside, what I find striking is that President Obama has commented on this, and he didn't waste any time, which he never does. He seems to have a knee-jerk reaction to always comment on any kind of racial incident like this. But we lost just recently, within the last 10 days, the highest-ranking American serving officer, a general, that we've lost since the Vietnam War. And the president still has not commented. He still hasn't said a word about it.
That is such a good point.
What kind of message is that?
No, that's a very good point. I think we talked about this last week, too, how it wasn't even the president who broke the story, or not broke the story, but reported the story. It was like, some State Department spokesman or something. This should have been that ranking of an officer, that should have been at the very least the president going into the White House press room and reporting that story. Well, speaking of the president, he also came out today to talk about Iraq. He's got a little problem in Iraq. Lots of people thinking that we're going back in, and, you know, I'm not really sure what he's doing, Barry, but it seems to me that if you're going to do it, better do it right, because you're just deferring, you know, you're just postponing the inevitable that at some point we're going to have to fight these people, and the quicker we start, the easier it will be, as we've learned in previous wars.
Well, yes, he said he had a little problem. A little problem is he hasn't a clue what he's doing. There is no strategy.
I was being kind.
To deal with what's happening.
I was being kind to the president here.
Well, I mean, it's striking that the Pope seems to be more bellicose than the president.
Isn't that just absolutely fantastic that you now have the Pope? I mean, I loved it because I love this Pope anyway, Pope Francis. But for him to Pope Francis to basically come out and say, "Hey, get the B-52s ready," he didn't say that, of course. But I mean, he's basically saying, "Hey, this may be a time for war." I think that's great.
Well, you know, there's an old Bird song from the 1960s titled "Turn, Turn, Turn," and one of the things it says is a time for war and a time for peace, you know, a time for love, a time for hate. That's out of the book of Ecclesiastes.
That's
right. Out of the Bible. Even the Bible recognizes there's a time for war. And,
right.
You know, we are at that point. You know, ISIS needs to be brought to heel now. It's just going to get worse. They just took some towns in Syria. All we have is the best financed, the largest, and absolutely the best equipped terrorist army in the world, and probably the best equipped army in the Middle East.
Right.
Because now ISIS, since it has our equipment. And, you know, if the Iraqi army doesn't stand against them, which they won't, if the Kurds can't stand against them, which they can't, who's to say the Jordanian or the Saudi Arabian army are going to do any better?
Right. No,
so
I think you're right. We're the only ones, Barry, we're the only ones with the air power to actually harm these people. I mean, there could be a lot of countries that want to fight them, but they don't have really the resources to fight them. So we're the only ones with the air power to really hurt them or cripple them. And that's why, you know, I've been advocating we should do something from the air. You know, we don't have to send 160,000 men into Iraq again. We may have to send some, but not obviously a big number. But we definitely should be flying some missions and hitting them very hard, Barry.
Yes, we should. I said years ago, and I was the only one, there was many, many people from my point of view who said this, that if we pull all the troops out of Iraq prematurely, that Al-Qaeda would take over. And that's exactly what's happening. Those who don't know the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. The truth is those who learn the lessons of history are doomed to watch those who don't learn the lessons repeat them. And that's what's happening. We're led by a national, really perhaps an international leadership that is historically ignorant, historical ignoramuses. And
right. That's
why they have no clue what's going on.
That's right. Now, we're going to be talking about World War I today, but I wanted to, you wanted to say something about Putin. So let's get that in on the table, and then we're going to move into our program tonight about World War I. But you mentioned you wanted to say something about Putin.
You know, we did some programs back earlier in the year, back in springtime, when Putin was moving on the Crimea, which, by the way, he has, you know, chewed up and digested now and is ready for his next meal, this case being eastern Ukraine. And we call those Tsar Wars, as in the Tsar of Russia. And now we're into the second chapter of Tsar Wars, where the empire strikes back. And what's happened is that the Ukrainian government is making great strides at, you know, eliminating separatist enclaves in the east. And they've been pretty much confined, the pro-Russian separatists, the pro-Russian militias, who are probably heavily infiltrated by and led by Russian Spetsnaz or GRU, G-R-U, Special Commando Forces. They've pretty much been confined to a couple enclaves like Donetsk.
And they're risking losing the whole thing and being crushed by the Ukrainian government. So now Putin has moved, made his next move on the chessboard. And what he's done is he's outfitted several hundred buses, or not buses, trucks, filled with so-called humanitarian supplies. And these are just about to cross the border now at an unmanned checkpoint. Our checkpoint's actually held by the separatists. And once they get into the country, they will break the siege of Donetsk because the Ukrainians won't dare shoot at them for fear of bringing Russia into the war even more actively than it already is. And these trucks will basically resupply the separatists with everything they need and then perhaps fan out and provide a sort of a shield in front of the roads and blocking the roads, so that the Ukrainian army has to back off or fight its way through these Russian forces. So in essence, his next move is to put a shield around the enclaves held by the separatists, resupply them, and then dare the Ukrainian government to do something about it.
By the way, Barry, I just thought you would enjoy hearing this, that Leslie just sent a text saying she thought your comments about the Pope were very good.
You know, she's a Catholic. You know, she must be very proud of this Pope.
Well, listen, I am too.
You know, and it's funny because he's named Francis for a reason. Francis was perhaps one of the most pacific
right.
of saints, you know, Saint Francis.
Mm-hmm.
Yet this Pope is more warlike than Obama, which speaks volumes.
Well, I think he is. He's seeing what you and I are seeing, and lots of other people are seeing, a battle between good and evil. And he understands, you know, usually the Pope is a peaceful man, and he wants peace rather than war, and I understand why that is. But I think he sees evil, and he's putting it in very plain terms that this is a battle against evil forces, and he would like to see the good guys win. I think that's what he's trying to, 'cause he cannot say it that way, but that's what he's hoping will happen. Well, let's get into World War One here. We're going to be looking tonight. This is our second installment of the show about the war. And tonight, last week we sort of set the landscape of what was going on in Europe at the time. The event that led us to the beginning of this war. So why don't we take it? Where do you want to start right now, Barry? On as we look at this chapter of the show.
Let's start on the Western Front. We left off with the kind of description of the belligerents and what triggered the war. And it's important to remember that unlike World War II, World War I was not a war over territory. It was not a war over territorial conquest like, you know, Hitler's trying to conquer Europe. This was strictly a war that happened by accident with alliances and, you know, interlocking alliances and commitments that just triggered based on a flashpoint in the Balkans, a series of dominoes that led all the various powers of Europe to declare war on each other when their governments really didn't want to. So, but all of them had plans, and they say that, you know, everyone has a plan until they get punched. All these plans came to nothing, but they were very interesting anyway, particularly when you describe what they expected to happen and what, you know, actually happened. You know, the French went off to World War One. August 1914, about 100 years ago, expecting to sweep into Lorraine, which is the territory between the Ardennes Forest, where the Battle of the Bulge was fought in the Second World War, and the Swiss border, and to, you know, basically with bayonets, because the French were still thinking in terms almost of Napoleonic warfare, where they fixed bayonets and charged forward with this tremendous spirit they called elan, and drive the Boche, as they called the Germans, back across the Rhine River. And this was Plan 16, French Plan 16, a massive attack in what would prove to be the center of the line between Switzerland and the Ardennes. And if you think geographically, just think of, you know, places like Metz and Strasbourg. That was the target. These were places the Germans had taken from them in the Franco-Prussian War, and the French won them back. So these are highly disputed territories. Now, the Germans had their own plan, which took advantage, in fact, of the French plan. The French would be attacking Lorraine, which would be the German left, if you think of left hand and right hand. And the German left hand was going to kind of back up and backpedal, let the French come. Let the French get as deep into Lorraine as they could, while the Germans, using what was called the Schlieffen plan, because it was developed by a general named Schlieffen back in the late 19th century, would mass almost all their forces on their right flank, their strong right arm. And they punched through Belgium, which the terrain favors them because it's pretty flat. And with very little terrain to stop them, they'd roll rapidly through Belgium and strike into northern France for Paris. And once they took Paris, the French capital, they would then make a left turn, kind of a hook, and take the French armies in Lorraine from the rear, cutting them off from the capital and attacking from the rear. And they thought they could wipe out France and end that war within the first few months. And that was important because they needed to buy time on the Eastern Front while that happened because the Russians were coming. Now, the Russians were slow. Russia has tremendous geography, but it takes them long and tremendous manpower, but it takes them a long time to mobilize that manpower across that broad swaths of territory and to mobilize their troops and get them to the front, get them to basically what's Poland, where the battle was. So in August 1914, all these plans are put in place, and the Russians are slowly massing in Poland, the Germans are pushing to Belgium, and the British land and tried to oppose them in Belgium, and are pushed back in what's called the Battle of the Frontiers. The Battle of the Frontiers were skirmishes fought in Belgium, where the French army was pushed back and the British were pushed back by this massive force of Germans. And when I say, these are skirmishes which crossed the, 500,000 men. So these are even the opening skirmishes of this war boggle the mind when you talk about casualties. And we talked last week about why, because the tactics did not keep up with the firepower and the devastation of the weapons at the time. And the Germans pushed down towards Paris. Now, what occurred that saved France was an odd thing. The German commander who commanded German forces at this time was not up to snuff. He was a guy named von Moltke the Younger. His father had been a great commander in the time of Bismarck. That was von Moltke the Greater. And he had won the Franco-Prussian War. But his son was not up to snuff, and he'd watered down the Schlieffen plan by taking forces off the right wing and putting them into the left wing. So rather than giving ground and letting the French push as deep into Lorraine and back into the Rhineland as they possibly could, so it'd be impossible to extricate themselves in time to save Paris, the Germans had put enough troops there to actually stop the French. And what ended up being a reverse, stopping the French offensive into Lorraine actually benefited the French because now they were closer to Paris. They didn't penetrate as deeply to the east as they could have and they should have. So General Joffre, the French commander in this area, used every means he could to rapidly pull those troops out of Lorraine. I mean, even used taxi cabs. French taxi cab drivers from Paris drove eastward, picked up troops, packed them in like sardines, and drove rapidly to the Marne River, which runs east and west and to the east of Paris, and rapidly patched up a new battle line facing towards the north. And as the Germans came barreling towards Paris, they found themselves facing a new line of defense, and this was the Battle of the Marne. And it's called the Miracle of the Marne because it shouldn't have happened. It was a miracle the French were able to create a new battle line and stop the rupture when they did. But it saved France, and it completely screwed up the German plans. So that's what happens in August in 1914, the very beginning of the war. And by the way, the Battle of the Marne cost about 500,000 more men and casualties. So again, very bloody battle.
Now, let me ask you, if I may quickly, Barry, ask you a question about that. I remember, in Gettysburg, we talked about that one time, and you mentioned that a lot of the losses, I think it was 63,000 men at Gettysburg, that a lot of it was just they just didn't have the medical care for them. So you'd be wounded today, you would be fine, but back then you'd be laying there on the grass, and they just would never get to you, so you either bleed to death or whatever, or just die from infections. So when you have casualties of this level, is it because they just didn't have the medical care to attend to them, or were they using weapons that the men had never seen before?
The latter, not the former. There have been a great strides in ambulance services by World War One. You know, if you remember Florence Nightingale, she was the nurse, and British nurse, who during the Crimean War, the 1850s, had first pioneered the nursing services when it comes to war. Before Florence Nightingale, there was no nurses that accompanied armies. Instead, soldiers between battles in a campaign were expected to go out there and when time allowed, and drag men off the battlefield after the battle was over, often a day or two later, back to the rear, where surgeons could take care of them. And, of course, surgery in those days was real butchery. It was usually a matter of just sawing off limbs that were wounded rather than trying to patch them up. But by 1914, every army had its own ambulance corps. In fact, Ernest Hemingway served in an ambulance corps in the Italian front. There's anywhere a book about it, in fact. So that wasn't the problem. The problem was that by 1914, artillery had become much more advanced than it had ever been before. It was heavier. There was more of it. And when I say heavier, meaning there was it provided a heavier explosive power. Not that it was weighed more, but just that the amount of explosives it delivered was tremendous. And they had light, medium, and heavy guns, including guns that were basically not much different than a battleship gun, but they were just mounted on railroad cars. And some of these had ranges of up to 21 miles. And there were lots of them, and sometimes hub to hub across hundreds of miles, there'd be this artillery. So advancing in the open became suicidal. And yet the tactics called for that. The tactics still called for masses of troops, basically shoulder to shoulder, and often in lines stretching for many miles. Troops would advance at a run across open ground, and the ground in Flanders, where basically the battle lines got drawn up, and the Western Front were pretty open. There was almost no features, almost no terrain. And that led to the second thing that created all these casualties, which was the machine gun. That hadn't existed before World War One. It just began to come into vogue after the Civil War with the Gatling guns. But this is the first war where they're used in mass. And the Maxim machine gun was much more effective than a Gatling gun. And the third thing was barbed wire. Barbed wire was used along with trenches. We'll get to trenches in just a minute. But barbed wire was used to slow men down long enough that they were even better targets. So you have rifles. Every man's got a...
Yes. Go ahead and finish. I had a quick question about... Now, when these soldiers were sent to war, did they know that these weapons, they were going to be running into these weapons, or were they still sort of mentally fighting the last war? I mean, did they realize that they were going to be, you know, facing machine guns that could take out a dozen men within minutes? Did they know that?
I don't think so. I mean, yes, you theoretically, if you're a commander in those days, you knew the power of a machine gun, knew that artillery, but their tactics didn't evolve with it. So I don't think they practically understood just how stupid and foolish and senseless offensives would be against this sort of firepower. That the only real answer was the answer the Germans came up with soon after, which was dig in deep, and fight on the defensive as much as you can. Let them come to you. What happened after the Battle of the Marne was what was called the Race to the Sea. When the Germans are pushed back from the Marne, they immediately tried to get around the open left flank, the western flank of the French and British forces, by racing towards the English Channel and trying to lap around the left flank of the French and British. First by near Paris, then further west continuously. And each time they tried that, the French and British would leapfrog around their, what became their right flank. So it came this leapfrogging towards the sea, each side trying to outflank the other. And that lasted for about a month until by September, October, the battle line was drawn all the way from the English Channel, clear to the Swiss border, in sort of a northwest to southeast diagonal line across France. And it would not shift and change much more than 25 miles either direction until the end of the war. And that became the Western Front. And the Germans very quickly, before anyone else realized that the only thing to do was to dig in.
And they did. And they built these massive trenches, each one about 6 to 8 feet deep, 5 to 6 feet wide in some cases. And they had bunkers where the men lived, and barbed wire was strung in front of them to slow down any attacker. And artillery was far in the rear to support those lines. And the British and French then followed suit, and this became the stalemate on the Western Front for the next 4 years, as troops would try to cross the land in between the trenches, that was called no man's land, between the German and the Allied trenches. You know, it was a flat, pockmarked with artillery, you know, explosions. They create these craters. So it looked like sort of the map of the moon. This pockmarked, a devastated region called no man's land. And throughout the war, there'd be various battles where one side or the other would launch an offensive trying to break the stalemate, and it would just be a bloodbath. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. So that's what happened on the Western Front in 1914, with all plans basically coming to naught. And a war that was supposed to end by Christmas would now take about 4 years. On the Eastern Front, something else happened. The Russians finally got into the battle, but it wasn't good for the Russians. The Russians pushed into East Prussia while the Germans were fighting the Battle of the Marne. The Russian armies pushed into East Prussia, where two German generals that would become very famous later in the war. One was Paul von Hindenburg, and you may remember him because he was the chancellor, I'm sorry, he was the president of Germany,
right,
that appointed Adolf Hitler as chancellor.
That would come about 20 years later, I guess, or not quite 20, yeah, just about 20 years later, right?
About 20 years later, yeah, about 18. In 1932, he would appoint Hitler as chancellor. That's when he was president of France. But at this point, he was president of Germany. At this point, he was a general on the Eastern Front. And his chief of staff was another famous character that would be later become a cohort of Hitler's, actually joined the Nazi Party. His name was Erich von Ludendorff. And von Ludendorff was to ultimately become probably the most successful German general of the war. And the chief on the Western Front eventually. But at this point, he was just chief of staff on the Eastern Front, meaning he's the guy that kind of arranges the orders, makes sure that the commander's orders are carried out, that are put into some kind of written form, and everybody knows their role. And the Germans are better than that than anyone else. They're better at staff work than anyone. And at a place called Tannenberg, which was the site of a famous Polish victory over the Teutonic Knights back in the 15th century. The Russian Second Army was trapped in a battle in which they're surrounded on three sides by the Germans, Ludendorff and Hindenburg's forces. And this battle of Tannenberg, the Second Army was wiped out. The Russian Second Army was just annihilated. It was a classic textbook battle. There's only a few battles where tactics and strategy and maneuver actually came into play in this war, in Europe anyway, in a big way. And it led to the stalemate on the Eastern Front as well, as the Russians were forced to pull back, and they too began to dig in. So you got somewhat something like the Western Front happening in the East, but not on the same scale. There was more offensives and counteroffensives in the East. And the Russians took tremendous casualties throughout that war. Eventually would lead to the fall of the Tsar entirely, the fall of the Russian Empire, but we'll get to that later. So 1914 ends with stalemate on both fronts and a tremendous bloodbath. And 1915 begins with each side trying to find new ways to get around this. And the Germans were the first ones to come up with what they felt would be a winning way of breaking the stalemate. And that was used for the first time momentously on April 21st, 1915. And this was the Battle of Second Ypres. And Ypres, the Germans used a first-time poison gas, something that would become a hallmark of warfare on the Western Front and throughout World War I, and something so hideous that it would be banned thereafter. And even Hitler would never use it in World War II, even as Germany was going down in flames, he didn't use gas warfare. That's how ugly it was. And he was at this point a soldier on the Western Front, a corporal eventually, and himself a victim of poison gas late in the war. But the Germans unleashed chlorine gas. They took chlorine and they lit it on fire and with gas canisters, and they dropped it into the French trenches, lobbed it in the French trenches.
And the French were open. The Germans with gas masks came swarming through the Allied trenches. And then they made some ground. But eventually they were held up. And once the lines where the gases were actually dropped was bypassed and pushed past, they were then stopped, and the British and French retook those trenches. And then both sides started using poison gas thereafter. So, unfortunately for the world, that's when poison gas first comes into use, is in the Battle of Ypres, 1915.
Barry, one quick question. Did all this gas also impact civilians or just soldiers?
Just soldiers. Unlike World War II, where you had street fighting and the battle lines were very fluid,
right,
with towns being fought over, the Western Front and other places was mostly in the countryside, and circumscribed to a fairly small area. I mean, consider everything. It was probably 25 miles broad and several hundred miles long, but there wasn't civilians in the actual battle.
How was the gas delivered? Was it by guns or by air? I mean, how did they actually fire the gas?
More often than not, it was artillery shells. And by the way, nothing's really changed. Now we still deliver when we deliver chemical or biological agents, it's still delivered by artillery by and large. But you can drop it from planes or deliver it in other means, but that's, rockets, for instance. But artillery was a predominant one. By the end of the war, gas guns with gas canisters that could be hand-delivered and thrown like a grenade.
The famous German stormtroopers of the late war would use gas canisters in that fashion.
Wow.
So, another way, the British tried their own way of breaking the stalemate. Now, one of the other belligerents in the war that came in was the Ottoman Turks. Now, Turkey at this point was called the sick man of Europe, and it had been the sick man for a long time, meaning that it was an empire in decline. If you think back to the 16th century, at their heyday, the Turks had really been the greatest menace that Europe had. The Turks were pushing into the Balkans. They pushed all the way up to Vienna. We had a show, if you remember, with Rick Fox, about how the Polish winged hussars actually saved Europe by stopping the Turks at Vienna. And that was in the 1680s. But by 1914, the Turks are declining, decaying empire. But they still control a lot of territory. They control virtually the entire Middle East, including Arabia, North Africa, Egypt, Syria, of course, Iraq, Mesopotamia, that area, and what's modern-day Turkey, and a good deal of the Balkans. Greece had become independent. Bulgaria was independent. Serbia, of course. But everything south of that was part of the Turkish Empire. And the British, at this point, were led by, at least their navy, was led by a guy by the name of Winston Churchill. And Churchill was, of course, later become Britain's wartime prime minister, one of the most famous prime ministers in British history during the Second World War. But at this point, he was a younger man. And he was first Lord of the Admiralty, which means basically Secretary of the Navy. And he proposed a campaign in 1915 to break the stalemate and knock the Turks out of the war. And the plan called for an amphibious invasion in April of 1915, about the same time the Battle of Ypres is happening, which would have basically New Zealand, Australian, and some British forces landing by sea, supported by the massive British Navy, the most powerful Navy in the world. And they would land on the Gallipoli Peninsula, which is the northern part of the Dardanelles Straits, that leads from the GNC and eventually leads to the Black Sea, so it's the western end of the Black Sea entrance. And once they landed at Gallipoli on the Dardanelles, they would then march rapidly forward and take Constantinople, which was very close by. Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul, was in those days the capital of the Ottoman Empire. So the British fell with British naval power, the firepower of their naval guns, and this landing force of well-trained troops. They could land quickly, move rapidly from the beachhead, and knock the Turks out of the war with a surprise attack at their capital. Because most of the Turkish troops weren't there. Most Turkish troops were deployed throughout the Middle East. So this was Churchill's big plan, and he sold it to the Navy, sold it to the Prime Minister,
and it turned out to be an utter disaster. And it wasn't Churchill's fault. The plan was, I think, sound. Unfortunately, it was poorly executed. When the British landed on the beaches at Gallipoli, instead of moving rapidly inwards as the plan called for, you know, rapidly inland and attacking Constantinople within the first couple days, much like the Americans in World War II when we landed at Anzio, the Anzac forces, Australian New Zealand forces, and the British forces that landed there also, their commanders didn't move them off the beach. Instead, these guys who had been fighting on the Western Front and had experienced the British officers, started digging in and building up a supply depot. Now, if you think of Gallipoli, think of some beach you've been to where there's cliffs nearby overlooking the beach.
Right.
And that's what was Gallipoli. It had these high cliffs overlooking the beaches, and the British managed to get just up the slopes of these cliffs and then stopped while supplies were being landed ashore. And they stayed there for several days while the Turks basically got their wind back. And under a guy by the name of Mustafa Pasha, later known to history as Ataturk, the founder of the modern Turkish state, sort of the George Washington of Turkey, modern Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a general back then, and this Mustafa Pasha happened to be nearby. And he gathered whatever troops he could, and he rushed them down the Gallipoli Peninsula, which is fairly narrow. And he set up a roadblock, you know, basically overlooking the cliffs. And the British sat there for the next year unable to move. It turned into basically one of the larger self-supporting prisoner of war camps, if you will, in history, as the British would try periodically to go over the top of those cliffs and were just gunned down by Turkish machine guns as the Turks had set up trenches at the top. It was an utter disaster. And Churchill was forced to retire after that. He was just fired, or he quit, and would spend the next 25 years in what was called the political wilderness, where no political party would touch him. You know, he was radioactive. And kind of like the neocons are today, you know, some of the older neocons from the 10 years
right.
ago, like Paul Wolfowitz. You know, they're sort of radioactive. Nobody takes them seriously anymore. That was Churchill until World War II and Hitler. And the only reason he came out of the wilderness then is he had been the only one guy, you know, predicting Hitler, you know, was a menace from the 1930s on. So he was, of course, proved right.
Right. One quick question, Barry. You mentioned All is Quiet on the Western Front. Oh, no, you mentioned the Western Front. There's a movie or a book, right, called All is Quiet in the Western Front. Isn't that right? I think I've seen that.
That's right. The famous
anti-war book. It's based on this battle.
It's based on the various battles on the Western Front. And it's told from the German point of view, a German
mm-hmm.
soldier who is, like many of these kids, he's, you know, we've heard the term jingoistic. And really that term comes from this period. The teachers in the schools had really bought into the whole nationalistic pride and militarism that was rampant throughout Germany and really much of Europe at this point in history. You know, all the countries are very nationalistic, a lot of national pride, and they're very militaristic. You know, lots of public support for the military. And the book is about how a young class of German youth are basically talked by their teachers, who's a veteran of the Franco-Prussian War, into joining the military in the middle of World War I, and they're told how glorious it'll be, and they're fed all this romantic nonsense. And they go off there, and they realize when they get there just how ugly it really is.
Right.
And there's just no glory to be had in them.
Right. I think the movie, in fact, starts out in the classroom, I think, if I recall. A young
That's
guy
right.
who's all excited about war, and then they were all excited. Now, is all of that excitement about war, the fact that that so many people in Europe at the time had not experienced war?
Well, that's right. They'd only not experienced war because there'd been, ever since Napoleon was defeated in 1815, there had not been a general war in Europe. There had been a very short war between France and Prussia in 1870. And there'd been a Crimean War, but that was way over there in, you know, the Crimea, obviously, and the Black Sea, and most Europeans weren't involved with it. And the forces involved were really small, comparatively. There had been a brief war between Austria and Prussia, but that was about it. Most Europeans had not experienced war.
And also concurrent with that was this, in the 19th century, was this whole romantic notion of war that grew up. And you see it in the paintings, you see it in the artwork, some of which is some of the nicest and the most, you know, inspiring art about war, showing pictures of, you know, Napoleon on Calvary charging, or troops of the Seven Years' War under Frederick the Great. There are all these wonderful paintings, the battles of Waterloo and so on, that were painted at this period that romanticized war, made it seem very glorious.
Right, but those wars were being fought by almost men, you know, one-on-one, whereas now in World War One, you had a machine gun that could take out 50 people at one time.
Or one artillery shell.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a single artillery shell could take out 20.
Right, so all of a sudden, you know, what was very romantic, you know, on the horse charging, now is pretty bloody. I'm sure that must have been quite a shock for a lot of these soldiers when they got out there. I mean, maybe they were told that it was going to be rough, but you still really don't know it until you actually do it. And I think a lot, if I remember from that movie, All Is Quiet in the Western Front, a lot of those young men out there in the war zone were just like, you know, they weren't expecting it to be this hard, Barry.
No, and you know, if you think of 1914, in August 1914, the French marched off to the front initially wearing blue coats and red trousers. You know, their uniforms had not changed much from the Franco-Prussian War. Which, by the way, they weren't changed a whole lot since Napoleon. They actually still had cavalry wearing brass helmets and cuirasses, breastplates, steel breastplates, steel or brass. They still had lancers. Every army in Europe had lancers in 1914, cavalry, mounted cavalry. And in fact, in Mons, they actually had British had a cavalry charge, and that was during the Battle of the Frontiers, the very first month of the war. And cavalry would continue to be used on the Eastern Front, where there was lots of room to maneuver relatively. But very came very apparent quickly that bayonet charges with men wearing, you know, blue coats and red trousers was just a really bad idea. So by 1914, by the end of that year, the French were wearing a very drab olive green brown combination uniform. The Germans had already changed earlier on to what they called a Feldgrau, or field gray uniform, which would be the same color they'd wear during World War II. And under the right circumstances, it actually acts as some kind of camouflage, particularly at a distance on the horizon in Western Europe. And the British were first in khaki and then went to a kind of a mud brown uniform. So they started to realize, and of course they went from soft hats to helmets, which
right.
would stop the shrapnel coming in from artillery shells bursting overhead.
Right. Barry,
by
I
the end of the war,
you
actually
idea
get them.
Yeah, go ahead and finish that thought. I wanted to give you an idea of the time frame. We've got roughly about 7 minutes in this segment, and then we'll have to continue the next time. So let's try to, you know, wrap it up in the next 7 minutes. But I was going to ask you a question as a follow-up to what we were just talking about. The officers must have been in a state of shock also, because they probably didn't realize how rough this was going to be. I mean, everybody see from what you're saying tonight and you said last week and from what I've read and so on, everybody thought this thing would end like in 20 days, that it would be like, you know, we'll just go in and, you know, kick their butt and, you know, we'll be home for the holidays, whatever the next holiday was. And that seems to be the impression they had, Barry.
That's very true. And in fact, the upper command, the generals at the top, were replaced very rapidly. There was always a high turnover rate among generals during World War One, especially on the German side. The Kaiser and his general staff expected results, and you find one chief of staff of the Prussian or German army after another being fired because they weren't able to break the stalemate. Von Moltke was fired very quickly and replaced by a guy named Falkenhayn, and he gets fired after the Battle of Verdun, which happens in 1916. That was his grand plan, was the Battle of Verdun. General French, who was the commander of the British forces, the British Expeditionary Force, actually seemed to have a nervous breakdown in the first month of the war, tries to pull the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, out of the battle in the first 2 months and take it into Normandy to rest. And he has to be replaced by General Douglas Haig. Well, happens to be the only commander from the first year that sticks around through the end of the war.
And he gets a lot of bad flack, but if nothing else, he did survive the war and all the firings of other generals. But there was constant turnover of generals. Now, on the other hand, there was a huge disconnect between the way the German, I'm sorry, the way the generals and the soldiers fought that war. While the soldiers lived in the absolute squalor of the trenches and the horror of the trenches, where you'd have often water and mud up to your knee in some cases, especially in the rainy season, where you'd have rats and rotting corpses all over no man's land, and some even in your own trenches, smelling up the area. And men would be getting dysentery and trench foot, or being gassed all the time and subject to artillery barrages. That was the common soldier's lot. But the generals lived miles behind the front, where the terrain was not devastated by artillery shells and still looked normal. And they lived in chateaus and castles, which had been turned into headquarters. And the closest they got to the trenches was looking at maps and pushing little flags around on map boards and sending out commands by telephone. And this had a huge effect on one of the participants. One of those participants was a German runner who ran orders from those chateaus, from the generals, and their headquarters to the front and delivered them by hand. And while doing that, he had to pass through these trenches and through, you know, sections where the trenches were not adequate and was subject to artillery barrage. It was a very dangerous job, and it was the life expectancy of one of these runners was very short. This man managed to do so well they survived the war and was actually decorated with the Iron Cross. And that man was Adolf Hitler.
Wow. Now, he was fighting for Austria? He was an Austrian soldier.
He was Austrian, but he basically adopted Germany as his home.
Oh, okay.
And moved to Munich. And he saw the way the generals lived and had nothing but contempt for those generals, the chateau generals. And this would play a huge part in the Second World War when he had nothing but contempt for his own generals. And he used to say that I was a frontline soldier. I know what soldiering is. I wore the great coat, you know, the great, you know, winter coat that they all wore. And he wore that, in fact, throughout the war. And he felt he was a real soldier, knew what war was really about, while the generals who had been at the rear and skulked in the rear and never got to the trenches didn't really understand war like he did. And it was this chauvinism that basically undermined and betrayed him during World War II when he really should have listened to his generals.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, thank God he didn't. Because
yeah,
if he had listened to if he had listened to the generals, who knows what the outcome would have been. Because he did have some first-rate generals in World War II. Well, let's wrap it up for tonight, Barry. Let's preview the next program. But one thing we were going to say, if we could just take a minute and talk about this, I asked you this question off the air, and let me ask you now. How did, I mean, when they took losses like these countries did, you know, 500, 100,000 in one battle, 200, whatever, where did these men, I mean, what did that do to their populations? That must have been devastating.
Well, it was. It decimated their population. The British, in 1916, in the Battle of the Somme, suffered, which was the 1970, which was the largest, I'm sorry, it was, yeah, 1917, was the largest bloodletting in history. The largest, you know, butcher's bill of any single battle. About a million men died in, it was 1916, the Battle of the Somme. And about a million men died. And it completely wiped out an entire class, entire graduating class of British youths. You know, the youths that graduated in 1915 went off to war. It was not just the graduating classes. It was also these gentlemen's clubs the British had formed, sort of like a boys' club, you know, Boy Scout sort of thing, where they young men would join these clubs, and they were late teens and early 20s, and they all joined regiments together. You know, whole clubs would join regiments, the same regiment, and become the officer corps. And at the Battle of the Somme, which we'll talk about next week, which takes place in 1916, July through November, a million men died. And of those, something like 600,000 were French and British.
And again,
completely
to put
wiped
that
out that class.
Yeah, to put that in some perspective, this is a six months you're talking about, right? A million men die in 6 months. World War II, the entire casualties were about 500,000 for the whole war, for the United States, obviously. Other countries had other losses, too. So, I mean, you just put it in perspective, and you know, when you're sitting there, of the impact that these losses must have had in these countries, it had to be devastating in their populations, the number of young men who never came home to start a family. I'm sure there must have been a lot of young widows at the same time, a lot of very young orphans. I mean, the impact, you know, it must have been pretty devastating.
It was. One of the side effects is that the best men go off to war. That's just the way it works. And I'm not just talking about physical specimens, though that's obviously the case. You don't allow in the military men who are physically unfit. Only the fit ones go to, you know, join the military or are allowed in the military. But also morally, often the best men go. You see that in today's military. I think the American soldier today, you find in the American military today, some of our best people, our finest young men and women.
I agree with that. Some of the in terms of character, and there's no question about that. No question about that. Yeah.
And I think at any time from basically Napoleon on, you pretty much had that, because you had these volunteer armies, and then you had conscript armies. Even with the conscript army, they had to at least be physically fit.
Right.
And when you're talking about the British officer corps, you're talking about these lads all volunteered, and they're filled with national pride. Those are the men who aren't reproducing for the next generation. You know, they generally have not married yet. They've not had children and families.
Mm-hmm.
So you've taken out of the gene pool your best.
Right.
And it particularly hit the French hard. The French had that happen to them first in 1815, actually between 1800 and 1815, with the Napoleonic Wars wiping out over 1 million Frenchmen. And then in 1914, 100 years later, it begins again with World War I. And then World War II comes along. And by that point, World War II, France surrenders fairly quickly because they're not willing to go through that again.
Mm-hmm.
It had a huge impact on why France collapsed in 1940 against Hitler, is that they didn't want to go through another 4 years of losing their best men.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that the generation that was produced after World War I was not bred by their best men. It was produced by those who stayed behind because they were unfit.
Right.
They had children. Yeah. They're the ones who produced the next generation.
And I think to some extent, even that... those attitudes about war are still present in Europe today. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Not so much next week, but when we get to the end of the series and we talk about the aftermath or the impact of World War I. But, Barry, we're going to have to wrap it up. We'll be back next week. So next week we'll pick up on the next battle. And I guess next week we're also going to get to the point where the United States comes in, right?
Yes, next week we're going to try to cover 1916 and 17. And the entry of the United States and the collapse of Russia. We're also going to be talking about the Lawrence of Arabia and the whole desert campaign that eventually created the modern Middle East. And most of the problems we're seeing in the Middle East with the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the Israelis and the Arabs, the roots of that can be traced to what happened in the First World War. So we'll talk about that too.
Excellent. Barry Jacobson, thank you so much again for joining us tonight, and we'll do it again next time. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to it, and have a great evening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to wrap it up with the music of Carlos Geddes, my good friend here in the Dallas area. We're going to wrap it up with his song. Thanks to Barry for joining us tonight. We will talk next week as we continue our series of shows about the history of World War I. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying goodbye.